We are very grateful for Mark Drakeford, the Minister for Health and Social Services, to give us an hour of his time to take questions, which is not something many ministers would do. Appreciate that, Mark. So what I intend to do is just ask a couple of initial opening questions, but really the floor is yours. So just to start off, Mark, could you just explain to us what is the difference between prudent healthcare and rationing?
Okay, well, it's a very good question because it's an accusation that's made about prudent healthcare, that it's a different way of using the term rationing. In an audience like this, it's important just to be clear, isn't it? All healthcare systems ration. It's not an easy thing to say on public platforms because it's immediately misconstrued what you are saying. But every single healthcare system, wherever it is, has ways of trying to match supply and demand. And the UK system is no different, except that it uses time as its means of rationing. So we shouldn't just sort of use the word as though it's some sort of unheard of concept in healthcare, because it's the most common concept you'll come across. The difference is that in prudent healthcare, what we are talking about is making clinical need the guiding principle in distinguishing between different sorts of demand. And that's why it has equity as one of its main merits. If we were able to run the health system on prudent care principles, it would mean that, in the absolute classic sort of Bevan concept, people's access to healthcare would be calibrated not by the accident of geography, not by the accident of birth, not by the ability to pay, but by the urgency of their clinical need. Those whose need is greatest would be at the front of the queue. And that prudent healthcare allows us to make that principle more effective in the way the system would operate.
It is striking to me, at least, listening to the discussions we've had, how complex this all is. Because you need, on the one hand, a culture change in the way people use the services of the NHS and how they self-manage more, and how their expectations are different, and also how the professions work and how the systems manages it. So you have two very complex things to manoeuvre at a time of economic stress, which is going to get worse, and a political cycle where 1 year off a general election, 2 years off an assembly election, you've got no majority in the assembly. Not that you need me to remind you of that. But how do you, as a politician, let alone a service leader, try and get those stars into alignment?
Well, the first thing that I felt we had to do was to generate a debate around this whole topic, to get the subject talked about, to get the principles that lie behind it debated, in order to create a climate in which you can attempt to do some of those very difficult things. And I've been very cheered up, really, by the fact that in just a few short months we've got a lot of people who are movers and shakers in the healthcare world to be talking about exactly this this topic. So part of what you do as a politician, if you're lucky enough to be able to, is to try and create some terms of debate. Being the health minister is not, on the whole, although most of the time that I'm asked questions about it, is not being in charge of what happens on Ward 3 in Merthyr Mawr. But it is about, if you're lucky, talking about ideas, getting people to think about them. Prudent healthcare is an idea that is not new. Wales is not setting off on some idiosyncratic path that nobody else has trodden on, but what it offers us, if we are really lucky and are able to do it, is to be on the leading edge of a movement that is happening in many other parts of the world. And if we manage to get in there early enough and embrace it quickly enough, then we're going to be in a position in Wales, I think, to be taking advantage of a set of ideas and ways of thinking about healthcare where we will be doing more in Wales than any other part of the United Kingdom.
What are the consequences of failure?
Consequences of failure, potentially, are that we will struggle more and more to go on running an unreformed health system. If we don't manage to engender change in the cultural dimensions that you mentioned, patient expectations, clinical attitudes and way of practicing, and if we don't actually change some of the things that we do, then trying to carry on as we are will become more and more of a failing project, I would say, because you simply cannot run a health service of the sort that we have today with consistently rising demand, consistently lowering resource, and think that there won't be a point at which those two things collide in a pretty nasty way. So failure to grasp a reform agenda, whether it's the prudent healthcare agenda or there may be others, you know, part of the debate may be to add other ideas into this. But the failure to grasp a reform agenda of some sort is that the system will more and more be in sort of staggering mode rather than the way we would want it to be.
Managing change in any organisation is tough. In an organisation the size of the NHS, it's considerably tougher. You need to take the staff with you. I think that's been a point made by Unison here today already. The figures that the Bevan Commission have talked about require annual efficiency savings of 4%. To date, according to Nuffield, we've achieved efficiency productivity advances of 0.4% annually, and we're facing a potential gap in public spending of over £2.5 billion within 10 years. Now, if one of the things, it seems to me, reading through the analysis, one of the easy things to do initially to try and get the savings is to further suppress pay and even to cut pay. How do you square the circle between making those expedient, perhaps inevitable choices, whilst motivating a workforce to deliver change?
Well, we have had some very difficult and challenging conversations with our colleagues in the trade unions in the health service in Wales. Here is the largest employer in the land, employing over 80,000 people, employing nearly 10,000 people more than were employed in it at the point of devolution, and where in 2013, despite the fact that we are 3 years into the age of austerity, the NHS in Wales added staff to its number rather than reduced staffing numbers. And in an organisation where 65% or so of your costs are in the cost of staff, then if you are trying to live within your means, it is unavoidable that the pay bill has to be part of what you scrutinise. And with our colleagues in Unison and other trade unions, we have succeeded through agreement and agreement in a ballot of members as well to make some changes in terms of and conditions which are not palatable to anybody, but which allow us to go on doing what we want to do. And this is my message always when I meet staff groups, is my ambition is to have as many people as possible working for the NHS and as many people possible being members of their trade unions. But if I can't do a deal with them on pay and conditions, then the stark fact is that there will be fewer of them in the future because there isn't any other option on the table. And by and large, most people who you talk with in the NHS, when you're able to explain to them that context, then they'd rather be in a job than not be in a job. They'd rather their colleagues be in a job and than not in a job, even if it means some painful accommodations to allow that to happen. And it is explaining to them, Lee, things which are harder, I find, to explain in recent weeks than they were a year ago. Because we are 40% of the way through the cuts that are announced already to public expenditure in the United Kingdom. But people turn their radio on in the morning and they pick up the newspaper and they read that the economy has, you know, turned the corner, we're back in the sunny uplands. Well, as far as public services are concerned, we are not even down the slope to the floor of the valley, let alone coming out on the other side. Now, when you're close enough to it and you can have the conversations, you can explain this to people and people are remarkably willing to see the limited range of possibilities that there are once you know where we're going to be. But it's harder for people who are further away from the conversation because they hear other things. And in some ways, you know, they've forgotten that the impact of cuts are absolutely real and are going on to be more real and more significant for the next few years, even than they have been for the last three.
Okay, I know there are plenty of questions, so let's open it up. If you could raise your hand, explain who you are, and ask a question.
I am June Clark, as said earlier, and I explained that my background was in nursing and health visiting, which means particular focus on prevention. And my question is about the reality gap, the gap between rhetoric and the reality. How can we reconcile a commitment to prevention and early intervention, and I'm thinking particularly about services for older people, while at the same time cuts mean that we are raising the eligibility threshold for access to services?
And a not dissimilar point to was made earlier by Alison Williams about the consequence of making these changes in a time of austerity rather than making them 10 years ago when there was money. And the example given was if she had some money to spend on voluntary services, it could well reduce the bill for mental health in particular. So there is a particular pain to this, isn't there?
Well, absolutely none of this is easy to do in a period of austerity where there isn't money to do so many of the things we would like to do. But there is no avoiding the prevention agenda, and there is no avoiding the conversation that we have to have between the citizen and the state, between the user and the provider of services, because so much of what the NHS has to deal with is avoidable harm that absolutely need never have happened. And if people want the NHS to be able to go on dealing with unavoidable harm, the things over which individuals have no control, then individuals are going to have to recognise that there is more that they will have to do in order to make avoidable harms genuinely avoidable. And that's not an easy conversation to have with people, because on the whole, the things that cause the harm are done now, and the consequences of it are years further away. But if we, I have found, if you use some very direct examples with people, you do get some extra purchase into the conversation. So if you use the results of the Caerphilly cohort study that have been, you know, in the news over the last few months here in Wales, so for people who are not so familiar with it, there is a 30-year study recruiting. The effort was to recruit every man in Caerphilly in sort of middle age and to track them for another 30 years and to see what impact upon their health in later life five basic health-related behaviours would have: not drinking too much, not smoking, taking exercise, eating a sensible diet, and one other which I always manage to forget. Sorry. So the five things. And then you see, 30 years later, what's the difference in people's health status. And they are just absolutely dramatic. The difference between adding just one extra of those five to your repertoire in, you know, middle age reduces your likelihood, not just of the things that we would have expected, like heart disease and vascular conditions and things like that, but the figures for dementia are remarkably reduced for people who do those basic things that look after their own health so that the harms that are there to be avoided can be avoided. And where the conversation becomes particularly tricky is when you say to people that if harm is avoidable and you choose not to avoid it, and then harm occurs, the first question cannot be, so what is the health service going to do about it? Because that's part of the discussion that Sharon was having about how we manage to share responsibility between the health service and the individual, rather than handing responsibility across the desk from one party to the other. Now, June's question is about how do we do all this when the budgets that are most under pressure are always prevention budgets, because you're always having to deal with the harms that have already happened in the here and now. I don't have an easy answer to it, but there are some good examples of where, by recalibrating services so that in the prevention agenda as well, we are real about the re-ablement agenda, then in the preventative side, we are not talking about drawing people into services. We are always talking about trying to do the most we can so that people don't need the service, and building up people's own capacities to manage as much as they possibly can for themselves, rather than creating a dependency on a service. And actually, in the field of elderly people in particular, some of the evidence is quite equivocal. Some of the stuff that I know I've probably said many times on platforms about wanting to try and provide some early preventative services for people who are just beginning to find some things a struggle so that they can go on managing for longer and so on. There is quite a bit of evidence that actually providing services of that sort early on accelerates people's path to dependency rather than arrests it. Because, you know, you say to somebody, well, there's no need for you to do that anymore because we'll send somebody around to do it for you. Theory is that frees people up to spend more of their energies on other things that they'll go on doing for themselves longer. But actually, what quite a lot of people learn from that is, oh, well, I could give up doing a few other things now then as well, and somebody will be around to do those too. So we've got to be smart about prevention as well, because we can go about prevention in ways that actually accelerates reliance on services rather than prevents it.
In terms of incentives for good choices and consequences for bad choices, Cardiff and the Vale have now a scheme where if you smoke or you're obese, before you're allowed on the waiting list, you have to go on a course. Is that something that you're looking on rolling out wider and in building on that principle?
I'm very, very keen on doing it. I think there's a lot of anxiety around when the policy was being developed. How would people regard it? Would the general public feel that this was some breach in the bargain that they thought they had with the health service? But actually, all the sort of tests of opinion show that people are very supportive of it, because the message from the scheme is not at all about not giving people treatment. It's about saying to people, there is no point in offering you this course of treatment unless you are in a position to benefit from it. If your weight is of a certain level, that orthopaedic procedure is simply not going to do what it would do for you otherwise. If your smoking is of a level that a procedure would be dangerous for you, because we know that from an anaesthetic point of view and a recovery point of view, your ability to do so is compromised, then that treatment is not going to work for you. What we say to people is, we want the treatment to work for you, and in order for it to be able to work for you, you have to work with us to put yourself in a position where you can benefit from it. So that's the bargain that we're talking about there with people. People putting themselves in a place where treatments can be effective, and recognising that there's no point in just ploughing ahead with treatments where the evidence is that they're not going to be effective because you're not in a position yet to benefit from them. Now, I want to do more of that in Wales, because one of the core principles of prudent healthcare is that we need to avoid harm and not do things that do no good. And in any health service, you know, there is evidence of anything up to 20% of what the health service does either does harm to people, healthcare acquired infections, or does people no good because that evidence has been overtaken by better evidence of things that could be done in a better way. And the Cardiff Optimising Outcomes project is really very consistent with that. There's somebody here who's very keen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Peter Price, among other things, former non-executive director of the ambulance service. The essence of this is about better decision taking. And to have better decisions, you need to have a range of alternative options. The health service at the moment operates in secondary care 24/7. Many of the alternative pathways simply are not there most of the hours of the week. What are you going to do about that? And in terms of time scale of achievement, you've illustrated the enormous financial pressures that are ahead as well as here now. What do you see as being achievable on this vast agenda in a short time scale?
That's a big question. I'd like to take one more, I think, before we answer it.
Thank you. Gary Evans, I was a paediatrician and lifelong Welsh nationalist. I want to follow up your point about avoidable harm, which is an absolutely important one. And you mentioned the role of the patient or the individual. But also, there is a responsibility of those of us who work in the NHS. And there is a consultant surgeon, heart surgeon in Cardiff, who's been suspended for the past 2 years because he complained about the post-operative care of his patients. And the management responded to the complaint by suspending him. And in the meantime, several dozen people have died on the waiting list waiting for heart surgery. Now, as a politician or as a doctor, there's a limit to what you can achieve to control people's lifestyles. But as a politician, there's an awful lot you can do to ensure that people who complain about the quality of care are looked after properly. So this gentleman who's been suspended for 2 years, that's led to everybody else shutting up, and that's led to the deterioration in cardiac services that we've seen in Wales over the past couple of years. So don't you think that you should be doing something to address that?
Let me take the last point first. I've absolutely no information at all about the individual that you refer to. Where you are absolutely wrong is any idea that that stopped other people complaining. I'm very willing to share my postbag with you, including those cardiologists from Cardiff who write to me very regularly. So they certainly have not taken the message that it is not a sensible thing to make their views known. The general point, Terry, that you raise is an important one, though. If we want prudent healthcare principles to work, then there is a huge job of work to do with the people who work in the health service and making sure that we regard them as a core asset in all of this and find ways of being able to mobilise the huge levels of commitment that they bring every day to what the health service does to this new agenda. There are big shifts in culture for people who work in the health service. I mean, I've worked most of my time in the sort of caring professions, and there is a natural tendency in all of us that if we see somebody who is in distress or who has something that is seriously concerning them, that our instinct is to reach out to them and say, you know, there you are, don't you mind, you give it to me, we'll see to it for you. And although the motivation is very understandable and honest, the impact of it very often is to disenable people rather than to enable them to do more. And this, I was struck very much by a conversation I had with a GP in West Wales, who is probably in his late 50s, I would say, and who said to me that in the last year or so, he had very consciously altered the very first encounter that he had with any patient who came in through his door. Because he said for most of his professional life, people had come through the door and sat down and he looked at them and said, "What can I do for you today?" And he says, now when people come in and sit down, I say to them, "What are we going to do today to address the issue that's brought you through the door?" He said, when I used to say to them, "What can I do for you today?" the invitation was to pass the problem over the table and put it into my lap and to make me and the health service responsible for it. When I say to someone, "What can we do today?" what I'm inviting people to do is to put the problem in the middle of the table and for me to bring what I can bring to solving it and to recognise, and this is where the cultural shift for clinicians comes, is for me to recognise the expertise, the real contribution that the patient brings with them through the door to solving their own problems. And that's the cultural shift that we have to make happen. Mm-hmm. Peter's question highlights something which I think I said in my Confederation speech in January when we first talked about these things, that if prudent healthcare means anything, it means a shift to primary care. Primary care has to be the engine of prudent healthcare. But we've said it in Wales for a very long time. The paper that the 10-year plan that Jane Hutt published in 2001, improving health in Wales. Now there we are, the title is very important. It wasn't tackling illness, it was improving health in Wales. A plan for the NHS with its partners said that our ambition for the health service in Wales was that it would be primary care led, that it would be driven by the principles of public health, and that it would be aimed at health improvement. And yet, my primary care colleagues would tell you here that the lion's share of new investment that we were lucky enough to have in that decade was sucked into the hospital sector for reasons we understand very well. So reversing that is difficult, but it is essential if we are going to be able to offer those alternative pathways to people, less intrusive forms of treatment, more self-managing forms of treatment. It'll be led through primary care. And then my last point, because I've been taught all day, is that also means that we have to grasp the nettle of the remodelling of the primary care workforce. I can say more about that if you want me to.
Well, I must say the example you've quoted doesn't give me a great deal of confidence that having not been able to deliver a 2001 plan, you're going to be able to deliver this one.
No, well, if you look at the history of trying to reform stuff in the health service, you wouldn't be a huge optimist, would you? Because it is a real, real struggle. I am in front of the courts. I think I counted in 7 different places in Wales at the moment.
Not wearing a suit.
Where we are judicially reviewed for decisions like wanting to move, not close, move 11 beds from one place to another. So change on any scale is difficult.
Isn't there some blame to be shared around here? Because just in terms of the expectations created, and you look at the budget figures, and you've talked many times about the severe choice and crisis that people face about the future of the NHS, given the UK government's decision to eliminate its deficit by 2017. So on the one hand, you're saying, look, there's less money around, we're going to have to do things differently. On the other hand, you're still producing strategies which are full of motherhood and apple pie. There was a lovely strategy the other day about neurological services, which suggested there were going to be all sorts of improvement in services. Wouldn't the honest thing to be saying is we'd really like to do this, but the other message we're giving out is there's less money. So given your track record in delivering strategies anyway, why are you still producing these strategies? You say you're going to do things which you can't afford.
I spend most of my days, sadly, meeting people who come into my office to explain to them why we are not able to do the things that we really would like to be able to do. But that cannot be a sort of gospel of despair that says that means that no change and no improvement is possible in anything, because what we know, neurological conditions would be not a bad example of that, but there are ways in which redesigning services, which is a lot of what prudent healthcare is about, a lot about deploying our workforce in a different way, means that even within the money that we have got, we are able to do things better than we are able to do things now. For your proposition to hold true, we would have to believe that every pound that we invest in every service is giving us the maximum possible return. We know that isn't the case. And with better planning and with doing things differently, whether that be in neurological conditions or diabetes or whatever it would be, there still is, even in really hard times, ways of squeezing more benefit out of what we've got.
Thank you.